everybody, and welcome to this, the latest episode of the Rewatch Project with Hannah and Mike. I am Mike, and with me, as always, is Hannah. Hannah was about to take a drink of tea and then realised that that was terrible timing, wasn't it?
Yes, and also that I was completely unprepared and didn't have the episode information in front of me.
Well, that's okay. That can be easily rectified. We are continuing with our coverage of Season 2 of Twin Peaks. I believe we have reached the 11th. Episode of Season 2, The Masked Ball, is that what it's called?
Yep, Masked Ball.
Okay, and who is the talent behind this particular episode,
Anna? Well, let's read the synopsis first. It says, Mrs. Briggs talks about her husband's disappearance into the woods. Nadine is put on the wrestling team where she falls for Mike Nelson. James is hired by the mysterious wealthy Evelyn Marsh. Dick takes on an orphan, Little Nicky.
Excellent stuff. Okay.
It is directed by Dwayne Dunham and written by Barry Pullman.
If I remember correctly, this is generally regarded as the worst episode of Twin Peaks.
Great.
But still pretty good.
Well, let's see what it's like on this particular rewatch.
Yeah, and I think what it is you can tell from that synopsis that a number of very silly subplots, all of which I think would be fine if they were the only silly subplot.
Yeah.
Are all happening together.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm a bit of a defender of this run of episodes of Twin Peaks. But even I concede that it's like, this is the one where I bet they were scrambling the most behind the scenes, you know. Yeah. They were trying to cast Windham Earle. They were trying to do all these things to get the show moving again. You know, and I think it shows a little bit, but at the same time, I seem to remember this being quite an entertaining episode, so I'm looking forward to watching it.
Indeed.
Quick reminder, a little bit of housekeeping that we appreciate feedback, and, you know, come on, Twin Peaks fans, step up. You can email us at rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com, or you can just leave comments on the YouTube page. Please do also check out our friend shows, namely Chinstroker vs. Punter, His Film, Her Movie, The Good, The Bad, and The Odd, Talk Without Rhythm Podcast, Film Bastards, and Video Game Landfill. And also do check out the Doctor Who reaction videos that I'm putting up on YouTube at the moment as well. They're quite short. They're only about sort of 15 minutes each, but they're nice and quick and easy to do. The thing I enjoy
and
about
it. And also, sorry to interrupt you, there's also quite a lot of chatter going on underneath each video of comments related to the video, judging from the email notifications YouTube comments.
Well, the thing that's interesting about it is it's really weird. It's odd for me because I know next to nothing about Doctor Who. Mm. So it's quite a, it's quite a vulnerable thing for me to actually be the person who, and I say that on the episodes. I'm like, look, I just ask questions when I'm watching it. Mm-hmm. And it's great because if there's something about it that's I'm not sure about, I can ask a question and then I know by the time I go to record the next episode, all of the answers will be...
That's one thing I was going to say. Doctor Who fans are really generous with their information and time and enthusiasm.
Yeah, I haven't had a single unpleasant comment.
I haven't read the comments all in full, but from what I can see, it's like, oh, did you know that a blah, blah, blah happened and this happened because of this? And
Well, it's old school fandom, you know,
I love it. It's great.
So that's nice. So check those out. The thing that I was going to say that I enjoy about doing those is that the old episodes of Doctor Who, they're like 20 minutes long.
Mm.
So content, baby. I can just sit down for 20 minutes if you're, you know, popping out with the kids and I can just, you know, watch one and react to it while I'm doing it. And then it's done. You know, it's really quick and easy. So check those out. Just to juice things a little bit, because we don't have any feedback this edition, is we are getting near the end of The X-Files, you know, with the original nine-season run. The ninth season, the final season, it's a short season. And we are, we're already, I think, three or four episodes into it. So the end is near.
Mm. I would have to say that surprisingly, I think one of my all-time favourite characters is John Doggett.
Yeah, and I think most people who watch The X-Files to the end would agree.
He's so good.
But most people, again, it's It's season two of Twin Peaks Syndrome. Most people weren't watching the show anymore by that point. It's interesting that the first episode of season nine of The X-Files aired, I think, like a week after 9/11.
Mm.
And a lot of people see 9/11 as the point where audiences stopped watching The X-Files, because I think America completely lost its appetite for questioning its own government. The baddies became others.
Yeah.
You know, whereas one of the things that was revolutionary about The X-Files was that it very much tapped into that kind of Nixon-era suspicion of government. Mm. And I think that after there was an external attack on America, that paranoia moved outwards.
Well, I think also a lot of people didn't want to feel like they couldn't trust the government that are trying to protect them.
Yeah, exactly, you know? Exactly. So I think that was the end.
Just being frightened.
Yeah, and you'll notice that the big show that took over the mainstream, which had many of the people from The X-Files jump ship onto it, was 24, which was very much about fear of brown-skinned people, basically. I mean,
and
if you look
also
at 20...
about things happening behind the scenes that you're never aware of.
Yeah, but it wasn't internal. It was external fear. But
you think like Homeland.
Yeah, exactly. It was very much that kind of fear of fundamentalism and all of that kind of stuff. But then, I think that it's moved back, and I can see why, again, they're looking to bring the X-Files. But the X-Files is one of those things where it kind of, a little bit like the character of Toombs on the show, in the way that it kind of goes into hibernation until, and the creators on the show have said as much themselves, until the world kind of needs it. And I think we have moved into an age now where America is jumping at its own shadows again.
Mm.
And that's when I think that show works. But going back to what you were saying about the character of Doggett and all that, I think the thing that's interesting about him that has only really occurred to me rewatching it, because I was only kind of half watching it at this time, because this was around the time that Buffy was at its peak, and you know, there was a lot of new shiny around. But I think the thing that's interesting about Doggett is that, unlike Mulder, he doesn't have a personal quest. He's just kind of a normal guy who is trying to do the right thing.
And has had a lot of tragedy in his past.
Yeah,
but
it's not like where the narrative force of The X-Files in its early seasons was Mulder's quest to find his sister and to get the truth. Doggett doesn't have a motivating quest apart from the fact that he just doesn't like assholes and kind of doesn't want to put up with that. So
he doesn't want to be part of a conspiracy.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't mean he believes all of it, but he also doesn't want to be part of some big cover-up.
Well, it's almost as though he doesn't believe in all the kind of supernatural stuff, but the stuff he's been told is the actual truth, he finds just as unbelievable.
Yeah.
But the thing, the big takeaway for me, though, on this rewatch is I honestly don't think the quality of the show has dipped at all. Over the entire run. I think the show's changed, and I can see why people might drift in and out, but it still seems as good as the biggest
surprise for me, considering how close and connected you are to Mulder and Scully, is how seamlessly Doggett came into it, and also how seamlessly Reyes has come into it. She is someone that you connect to really quickly.
Well, you just kind of, when you get an episode where you kind of don't even realise it. Like, we were watching one the other day, and by the end of it, I was like, this is all Doggett and Reyes. And I kind of hadn't even thought about it but it is interesting. But anyway,
that's lovely.
That's the end of the X-Files extra. I'm doing the X with the arms. I'm doing the Wakanda sign there, which is probably cultural appropriation, so I apologise. So we're going to hit pause. We're going to watch the 11th episode of season two of Twin Peaks, and we will then come back and we will discuss it. So back shortly. ¶¶
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, and welcome to Film Bastards, a podcast where three friends, two of them married and two of them podcasting life partners, chat everything from new releases, trailers, news, and an eclectic mix of other film goodies. Oh, and many, many, many tangents. You can find them by searching your podcast provider or check them out on Twitter and Instagram by searching Film Bastards. You never know, you might like it. And if you don't, well, we don't really give a f***.
And we're back. So we just finished watching season 2, episode 11 of Twin Peaks. Before we get into the episode breakdown, which I will need my phone for, Hannah, initial thoughts on this episode?
So it's definitely not one of the best episodes. Mm-hmm. Right? Let's just get that out of the way. But there is still a lot to like in it. And although it's light on substance, it's one of those functional episodes because it's having to set up phase two. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like, it's hard for it to be full of meaty
payoff,
yeah. I love David Duchovny. I love his character in this. Denise is fabulous and wonderful and, yeah,
great. And kind of progressive as well.
Yeah.
For the time. And you've still got, I mean, obviously this was made in 1990, so there's still the odd moment where you're like, ooh, okay, that character's responding oddly and things like that. Because, you know, over the last 5 years or so, we have come a long way. But the character is not really made fun of. And ultimately, from an audience perspective, the only perspective that matters is Cooper, is how Cooper...
And Cooper takes it in a stride and just... A bit like when Jadzia meets... who's the Klingon?
Oh, yeah, yeah, I know what you mean. He kind of became a meme, didn't it?
Yeah, about, you know.
He just corrects himself.
Oh, Curzon. Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I'm Jadzia now. Yeah. Oh, Jadzia.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was nice. I thought one thing I found quite problematic in it is the two instances of older women preying on barely legal boys. So Nadine, because she doesn't realise she's an adult, yeah, but it's still very much walking a very paedophilic line.
Well, I think that it's funny because that storyline is playing on the kind of ridiculousness of the age of a lot of the actors on Twin Peaks, the whole idea of that.
No, I get that, but it's still, I find it an uncomfortable storyline.
I know what you mean. It's like... There was always this thing, until relatively recently, that there was no such thing as female-on-male predatory behaviour. It was almost seen as being, oh, well, it's lads, they'd love it, you know. And we now, and you see this, you know, you see in the media a lot of cases of school teachers having sexual relationships with schoolboys.
Yeah.
And back in my day, you know, that would still obviously have been frowned upon, but there was a feeling of, oh, come on, mate, you know, you should be happy, you know, and I think
she wants the attention,
yeah, and I think that's something that in the early 90s still existed. It was almost as though there was something inherently comedic about a younger guy, but I do think in the case of Twin Peaks, when it comes to things like gender politics, it's tricky because Twin Peaks is so unreal.
Yes, you know. But I still find it deeply uncomfortable, the Nadine and Mike situation and Evelyn and James. It's just, and I mean, fucking Anna Green Gables is married to, you know, the Crypt Keeper.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is a lot of that in Twin Peaks anyway, but I think that it's, case by case, it's strange because I think, and it's difficult because we've got a very vague spoiler policy when it comes to Twin Peaks on this show. I think for the most part, we are assuming that everybody's seen it before.
Yeah.
But the thing about Twin Peaks as well is
because it's so many different styles mushing up, it's tricky. And I do think this point in the show is a little bit adrift, and I don't think the quality of the show is as consistent across these episodes. Mm. And I think also this is the point in the series where Mark Frost and David Lynch aren't as intensely involved in it. So there is a bit of drift there. But what I mean, though, is that the Evelyn and Jane storyline is a genre exercise, because it's clearly based on things like Double Indemnity.
Yeah.
And you saw that a lot at the time, like in silly cases like Wayne's World 2, or is it Wayne's World 1, where Garth is seduced by Kim Basinger.
Foxy.
And she gets him to, like, kill her husband. And that was a motif that was very popular at the time. And it all comes from noir films. And you saw it also in To Die For, the Nicole Kidman film, where she seduces the Joaquin Phoenix schoolboy. Yeah. And that was a genre storyline that was really popular at the time. And it all comes from Double Indemnity, where it was very much the idea of the femme fatale, the figure of the femme fatale, seducing an innocent in order to get them to commit a crime. And I think that in the case of the James storyline, that storyline is such a genre exercise that I think it's not necessarily completely sensible to attribute real world morality to that.
I get all that, and I know
you can still find it icky.
I know all the educational arguments about it's a, you know, genre study and all this kind of
thing. Not all of those storylines, but
but like I get what you're saying about, oh well, that's their take on the fact that all the characters are much older than who they're portraying, and this is their take on the 40s film noir and blah blah blah. It doesn't get away from the fact that it's gross.
Well, yeah.
What I'm trying to say.
I'm not disagreeing with you, Hannah. I know, this isn't an argument. I'm exploring what we're talking about.
I know, but it's sort of slightly like you're explaining it away. Like I'm
in that case, I haven't communicated very well. I'm not saying that you're wrong. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm not arguing with you. But I'm just trying to unpack where that's come from within the context of the show. Because the show's obviously made by very intelligent people who are very media savvy. And part of it is, as I said, the changing times, you know, the fact that things like that and things like referring to transgender women as he, things like that, like a character says that is now we are educated enough to know that you need to respect somebody's gender identity.
Yeah.
But that is, for most mainstream, and obviously Twin Peaks is a portrayal of a rural, a non-cosmopolitan area. That was something that we as a society...
I actually think the transgender thing was done pretty well. Yeah. Like, you know.
Yeah. So I'm not trying to excuse anything, but I think that right or wrong, I think that's where it came from. I think that in the case, that's where those things sprung out of. I'm not saying that they were successful in doing that, but...
I mean, obviously, I've seen these episodes before, but this is the first time that it's really not sat right with me.
Mm.
Not that I, like, was super down with it before or anything, but it just stuck out a little bit as I felt uncomfortable.
I think the reason I don't is, obviously on paper, yes, the idea of a 40-year-old woman having a relationship with an 18-year-old boy is weird, particularly in the context of them being in high school and particularly within the context of it being shown as just a quirky, funny thing.
Yeah.
And the show being agnostic in the morality of that.
Mm.
Absolutely agree. But at the same time, for me, I kind of, again, don't excuse that, but I guess don't get affected by it in the same way that when you have scenes with Bobby and Shelley and their kind of storyline, and then Bobby going, oh, I've got to go back to school, and us kind of getting pulled out of the show and being like, how ridiculous is it that character now has to go to school? I don't see it as much with Bobby and Shelley
because Shelley is quite young.
No, I'm not talking about their relationship. I'm talking about the whole forgetting that the characters are at high school because it's so absurd to think that they are.
Yeah,
So with the Mike and Nadine thing, I kind of bundle my compartmentalization of that in with the same kind of thought processes of the cognitive dissonance of Bobby being a career criminal and doing all this stuff, but still lying to his mum about where he is so he can stay out late.
Mm.
To me, there's a cognitive dissonance there
that is
similar to the one in that case. So I don't actually think of, when I've seen Mike and Nadine, my mind isn't thinking 40-year-old woman, 18-year-old boy, it's gross. It's thinking weird Twin Peaks storyline, and then occasionally thinking, oh God, yeah, he's meant to be a teenager. That's literally the way my brain interprets that. I'm not saying that's right or not bad, but that's what's happening when I'm watching the show. That's the grammar that's going through my sort of critical part of my brain.
I think this sort of really highlights the difference in the way you and I view things, because you look at things from a critical point of view, like a film critic point of view. You're very aware of how a shot is put together. You often, you get all the subtext and all that kind of stuff well before me, and you think of it in a more...
less literal way than you, which is why you figure storylines out beats before me.
But I think it's a reason that I find horror so hard to, well, I just can't stomach it, is I'm all in 100% believing everything that I'm seeing.
And that extends to, I see when you watch stuff, you get upset by characters' behaviour. So, you know, for example, Kirsch in The X-Files is the most recent example of that. You're like, you know, is he going to die? When's he going to die? Whereas, like, I'll be watching it, and that's like water off a duck's back to me. It's the Harry and Ron aren't getting along factor.
Yeah.
You know, as you watch things in a very literal...
I often wonder if there's something wrong with my brain, if that's...
No. Yeah. It's just, there's
not wrong with my brain, but... maybe other...
No, there's this really interesting book, film theory book called Watching, that came out in the early 90s. And it's basically just about how we watch things and how we absorb it and what happens to us while we're doing that and the differences with people. And this is exactly that, you know, is... And again, it depends on the thing that you're watching, of course, but... when I watch Twin Peaks, I don't apply the same gender politics or real world scrutiny to it than I would if I was watching a Sam Mendes movie or somebody, because you have to factor in authorial intent when you watch anything.
Yeah.
And that's something that you can do by reading about shit and just knowing that, or... it can be something that you infer. Yeah. You can watch something and go, I can see what they're going for here, even if you don't know anything about the director's work. That's what film grammar is.
Mm.
And Twin Peaks isn't interested in examining the gender politics of a May to December relationship. It's not that kind of show.
Mm.
It's a show that's interested in feeling... again, that word, vibe, and putting weird combinations of things together and seeing what the effect of that is.
Yeah.
So I don't think of... I mean, obviously on a base level I would, but I don't think of that as icky, because that's not the show. That's not the rules of the show. You know, it's just... so it's... I think a lot of it is seeing it as within the context of the universe of what you're watching. And you have to do that. And we do that as audiences all the time. Like watching The X-Files, you know, if you figure that each season is meant to be a year, it's like, well, when do the characters sleep? So when that Monster of the Week finishes, is the next Monster of the Week, is that the next morning? Are they just going straight into this other insane thing happening in their life? But you don't think about that because you know what the show is and you know which elements of it to interpret as reality and which elements to hand wave because it's a TV thing.
Mm.
And that's what I'm doing when I'm watching Twin Peaks. And again, I'm not saying that that's better or righter or anything like it, but that's what's happening.
Yeah. No, I get that. And I'm very much like after the fact, I can look at it differently. But when I'm watching it, I find any rule goes out the window for me. I'm in that particular scenario as me, a person being a fly on the wall kind of thing. And I guess that isn't great for looking at things critically and talking about it.
Well, it is.
As a step back, it means that my personal feelings colour everything.
No, but also, again, you're not wrong because at the end of the day, if the show was made now, I don't think they would have done that storyline.
No.
You know, for the exact reasons that you say. So that absolutely validates what you're saying. But again, I think it is an interesting thing to unpack because it's like when, and I don't really count it in the case of this episode because David Lynch wasn't involved in this episode, but of course his fingerprints are all over the show. And the show, where even when Lynch isn't involved, on some level is trying to emulate his work. And sometimes they do that better than others. And sometimes they don't try and they actually kind of succeed in doing this other thing. But I think that whenever David Lynch gets asked about gender politics in his work, he always just seems dumbfounded.
Yeah.
Because he's just kind of, he so just doesn't even think like that, that they may as well be speaking a different language.
Yeah.
Like I remember once somebody was talking to him about Blue Velvet and saying that they felt that the treatment of the character of Dorothy in that film was misogynistic. And he genuinely, it was such an innocent response. He was like, but that's just her. And they're like, yeah, but don't you think that that shows your how you feel about women? And he went, but she's not all women. She's just, that's just her.
Yeah.
And he wasn't playing devil's advocate or being upset. He genuinely seemed disturbed that they thought that.
Yeah.
And couldn't understand what they even meant.
Yeah.
Because he's like, but she's just one person that I wrote. There's loads of other women in this and they're not like that.
Yeah.
But I could see where the person was coming from who was saying that. But again, it's about intent. I think that if David Lynch was the type of filmmaker who was an emblematic filmmaker, who would centralise a character as representing a whole strata of society, then I think you could level that claim at him. But that isn't how he approaches storytelling.
No.
So it's kind of almost
very individualist.
Yeah, so it's only for, and I think the other thing as well is one big thing about David Lynch's work, which I think they're trying to emulate here, and again, not altogether successfully, is the idea of absurdism. And that's where the kind of sketch comedy element of Twin Peaks is always there, but is very present in this run of episodes is just the idea of putting mad shit together and seeing what happens out of pure absurdism. And there's nothing much more absurd than a 40-year-old woman at school dating the football star. But again, now we look at this from a modern sensibility, it's like that's probably not the most tasteful combination of things to put together, you know.
Yeah, because if you were to think about it the other way around, you'd be wanting to protect an 18-year-old girl from some creepy 40-year-old man.
That's a difficult path to go down to because then you start veering off into White Lives Matter 2 territory.
And also you've just had a season and a half of that scenario. Yeah.
And I'm glad that we are living in a world now where we do realise that there can be female on male abuse in relationships.
Absolutely.
And that all that macho shit's gone. But at the same time,
do you feel validated?
but at the same time,
just spoiler alert, I don't different. Abuse my husband.
but male men and women are different.
Yeah.
You know, it male
from Mars.
it's not the same.
No.
You know, So, well, should we go over a few highlights of the episode?
Well, I was just going to say, I think my favourite thing in this episode is Ben Horn.
Yeah, he's really great.
His descent into madness is kind of great.
Well, it's almost as though he's starting to become a human being.
Yeah.
It's like he's had to go through this transformation, this kind of traumatising experience.
I love the fact he's got a tie on with his pyjamas.
Yeah.
It's very Barney Stinson.
Yeah,
and, kudos to him for his shadow puppet skills, because they're pretty obvious.
They were, yeah. As parents, we tried to do that.
Yeah.
So we open up with James on his bike driving out of Twin Peaks. Now, it's funny, I'm going to mention here the Twin Peaks all-nighter that I went to at Battersea Arts Centre, the one I've mentioned a few times here. This is where I tapped out, and a lot of people did. And I don't think it was specifically, oh, God, James and Evelyn, we're going to go. But it was... This episode dropped at about 6 o'clock in the morning after an all-nighter.
Yeah.
And it felt like, okay. And I think that anybody who stayed then stayed to the end. Mark and Becky stayed and they did the rest of it. But we had to get back to Birmingham from London. And I was like, okay, we've had the Laura Palmer storyline. We've had the sort of episode or two after it where, you know, there's still a little bit of fallout. But, you know, by that point, it's like, I just want to get home now.
Yeah.
So I always associate, you know, that kind of morning after the night before when you hear the birds and you want to brush your teeth and you're gathering all your shit up and you're sleep deprived. Whenever I hear that music, I just associate that with feeling slightly gammy, you know.
Yeah.
And so we open up with it. And the other thing as well is that and they go outside of Twin Peaks a lot in season three, which is a different thing. But I think that this is the only time in the whole of the Twin Peaks TV show that we move outside of Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
And the show is so perfectly sort of hermetically sealed that should have been a sign. It's like, if you're leaving Twin Peaks, that's not good.
No.
And like I say, Twin Peaks The Return is a different beast entirely. It starts outside of Twin Peaks and we then move back into the town. So that's fine. But and in Fire Walk With Me, we see outside the Twin Peaks as well. But the actual original run of the show, it feels like if you're having to go outside of the town to follow characters, you've lost control of your narrative a little bit at that point.
Yeah.
And I think it was largely because they knew they wanted to keep James Marshall in the show, but they hadn't figured out how to do it yet. And he'd left town. And I think there's probably a certain amount of, he's on the opening credits, so he's getting paid, we've got to use him. So I think that this was a scramble. And I think what they thought of was, well, a lot of David Lynch stuff and a lot of early Twin Peaks was influenced by, you know, 1950s noir movie. Let's do a little noir movie with James outside of Twin Peaks. And they use the classic structure of, you know, like I say, the femme fatale, the sort of the older kind of spider woman, you know, who dupes this poor innocent into doing her sort of sinister bidding, you know. And I don't hate this storyline. And I think partly it is because Twin Peaks was a gateway drug for me, to a lot of areas of cinema and pop culture and music and movies and stuff like that. And I discovered film noir through reading books about articles about Twin Peaks and then talking about like Otto Preminger and Sunset Boulevard and Eight and a Half and, you know, all of the, and like I say, Double Indemnity and all of these great classic films. So I then sought them out and watched them, and I associate all of that. So when this storyline happened, I was already kind of immersed in that and was like, oh, they're doing a noir storyline. So I kind of like that element of it, the fact that although it's silly and it's a bit naff and it's outside the town, in some ways, it is in the spirit of the show to actually to do it that way. And so far, I've got no problem with the storyline beyond the fact that it's, you know, mopey James. And that's always piss take worthy, you know.
No one knows his pain.
No one knows his pain. We see Betty Briggs talking to Cooper and
I really
Truman.
Enjoyed her demeanor when she's talking about it, how unfazed and philosophical she is about the fact that her husband's gone missing.
And you also get the thing, you know, she knows stuff as well, so maybe there's a little bit more to her.
Yeah, she's just, she's very cool.
Yeah.
Like her.
And she talks about how he talks about the woods constantly as well, and he was trying to contact an element in the woods. We see the, we've got the backdrop of the Dougie Milford wedding. We get a call from Gordon, and I love the, I've always used this line as well, let a smile be your umbrella. I've used that at work before when people are having to do, it's the idea of just going with extreme positivity and don't let the bastards grind you down, basically. And you see Cooper do that when he goes into the meeting with Clarence Williams and the...
yeah, he's very upbeat.
Yeah, he's just, he smiles his way through it and he's like, well, I can't control that, you know, if you're going to do it. And we got, there's a great early Apple, chunky Apple laptop
The
scene as well. With the screen that looks like a calculator.
It really does.
And I like the way that when Cooper says it's time to face the music, he looks right at the camera as well. Yeah. It's like an almost fourth wall break. And I like the way he talks to the FBI guy about how he's now concentrating on a bigger game and like the sound of the wind through the pines. So we see that Nadine wants to ask Mike out. She has a moment with Donna. We see Evelyn for the first time as well, and we're out, like I say, we're outside of Twin Peaks.
Seems weird, James, like, ordering a beer.
Well, again, it's like you forget that they're meant to be so young. I mean, he's too young to drink.
Well, yeah. Isn't it 21?
Yeah. But, you know, but he looks like he's 30, so... there's a great, oh, he's pain when he puts the music on for jukebox.
I know, and he leans his head, on it.
No one understands.
No one understands.
We see Andy, he's introduced a little Nicky, and I love the fact that that's John Ross Ewing from Dallas. It's J.R. Ewing's son. So again, it's the, and it, I feel like that's intentional because we are moving into such, you know, naked soap opera territory, you know, around these episodes.
It is quite nice seeing the rivalry between the two men.
The Dick and Andy Show.
Yeah.
Love it. Because Mark Frost and David Lynch did a one-season sitcom straight after Twin Peaks called On the Air. And it was a little bit like a kind of precursor to 30 Rock.
Right.
It was about a... But it was set in the 50s, and it was about a live TV show, and it was a comedy of errors. And when I was on the Twin Peaks log, Mark and Becky had never heard about this, and it blew their minds because they love the Dick and Andy Show. But the lead actor in that show is Dick Tremaine. And like I say, it only ran for one season, but it's another show that Lynch and Frost did, you know, right after Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
And it's got the same look as Twin Peaks, and it's set in the 50s and all that. But it's a broad kind of almost... A lot of the stuff that they did early on in WandaVision reminds me of it.
Right.
In the way that it's like a proper old 1950s sitcom. But because it's made by Mark Frost and David Lynch, it has this undercurrent.
Yeah.
To it, it's really interesting. But that, I recommended it to them because tonally, it's season two Twin Peaks.
Right.
It's very much the Dick and Andy Show kind of stuff, but just kind of with any attempt at drama completely removed from it. It's a really interesting little curiosity. So we see Cooper talk to Hawk and Truman about the White Lodge. And I don't know why, but it doesn't bother me as much when Hawk does all of his, my people, you know, kind of talk, when it is specifically connected to the local mythology, because that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, if there is, in within the logic of the show, again, within the logic of the show, if there is an ancient evil or force or spirit in the woods, and we do know that they, you know, that that is a part of America where there is a large kind of, you know, First Nation presence, well, of course he would have a perspective on that.
There will be legend that's been told through generations. He will have heard it his whole life.
And so that element doesn't bother me as much as knowing that Josie was at the motel because of the smell of the oil on the floor, kind of like, you know, it's that.
Yeah.
You know, Tracker Hawk is, I think, probably a little bit more problematic than in touch with the spirits in the woods, Hawk, because that again, I think
that makes perfect sense.
It makes more cultural sense than I'm good at tracking because Tonto in the Lone Ranger was. But he says that a dark side to it called the Black Lodge, and that this is a place where spirits reside, and that
meet those your shadow self.
You meet your shadow self, and if you meet them with imperfect courage, it will obliterate your soul as well. We're introduced to Denise, formerly Dennis Bryson, and you know Cooper is instantly acceptant, but you do see a little bit of the small town in like Hawk's just in shock. And Truman's a little bit locker roomy, a little bit kind of like, wow, fucking, you know, you ain't from around here. You know, there's a little bit of that there.
Yeah.
But again, even by the end of the episode, you can see that starting to, that it's like this learned sort of behavior.
Yeah.
And
I just love the way David Duchovny plays Denise.
Yeah.
Like,
just so very comfortable with herself.
Yeah, and very subtle as well. Not overtly trying to be female.
I'm a lady.
Yeah. Yeah, not so much David Williams as,
Boy, that's a show that's not aged well.
Oh, God, no. No, that has not aged well at
all. I don't think that aged.
It wasn't, at the it time, wasn't really it was, at the time, yeah.
But, so, I mean, the only bit of this whole episode that made me jolt a little bit is when Truman refers to Denise as him.
Yeah.
But again, Truman wouldn't know that. He wouldn't.
No.
You know, I mean, it's funny because I knew nothing about transgenderism until a singer in one of my favourite bands came out as transgender. Against Me.
Against Me.
Laura Jane Grace, who was Tom Gable. And I was a fan of the band prior to her, you know, coming out and transitioning. And that was when I learned about it all. And that would have been about 2011, 2012, something like that. And I remember reading the article because she came out during an interview with Rolling Stone magazine.
Mm.
And immediately they started referring to, I say in air quotes, him as her.
Mm.
And I remember reading the article and thinking, why are they calling him her now automatically? Now that sounds awful, but I wasn't educated. I didn't know how important it was to respect that because I'd never met a transgender person. I didn't know what the difference was between a transvestite and a transgender. Mm. You know, I didn't know that. I'd never heard the word transitioning.
No,
I didn't know. I'd never heard of dysmorphia. You know, I didn't understand the psychology and the biology behind it because I just never encountered it.
Mm.
And the article, to the credit of Rolling Stone, obviously they knew that there were going to be a lot of eyes on this article because it was quite a high-profile thing at the time.
Yeah.
So they used it as an educational thing. And that was where I first heard the concept of a dead name.
Mm.
I was like, they explained what dead naming was and how, what an unpleasant, aggressive thing to do that is.
Mm.
And all of this stuff. And so I was reading it, and then I was like, oh, okay, so when somebody says, I identify as female, it's really important to respect that and to use the correct pronoun.
Mm.
That was when I learned that.
Yeah.
That was, like, nearly 15 years after this.
Yeah.
And Truman's meant to be a small-town sheriff.
Yeah.
So I don't think his character was meant to be malicious doing that. And I don't even know whether even the writer thought that was the right or wrong thing to do. It was early days, you know?
Very innocent in that sense. Yeah. Like, not with any malicious intent.
I think the heart's in the right place, but I think that it's...
The education was not...
Well, it's different now. It's, you know, we just don't have more of an understanding of it. But but I think that... I know that Twin Peaks is a very well-liked series in, for want of a better word, fringe circles, you know? So I don't think anybody sort of holds it against it. But it is interesting watching it now.
Yeah.
And we see, we learn that Josie worked for a man called Thomas Eckhart and that she escaped from him and Mr. Lee was sent to retrieve her. And she says to Harry that she believes that this Thomas Eckhart was responsible for Andrew Packard's death.
Yeah.
Her husband's death. We see Ernie and Hank. Palling around, and you know, we learn that obviously after her dressing down, that Norma's mum has returned to Seattle.
And you get the did you catch anything? Oh, I hope not.
Yes, we get a bit more of the Dick and Andy show in the diner as well. We've got James fixing Evelyn's car, and probably her too, if you know what I'm saying. And she talks about her husband. We get that great old Super 8 footage of the groundbreaking ceremony for the Great Northern. And I love...
With the same young boys that they used for the flashback to watching the girl dance with the torch.
And I love that kind of really brief moment of sensitivity where you see Ben touching his mother. Like he goes and touches her cheek.
Giving
her
a kiss.
And the sort of sadness that you see when... It's almost as though he's starting to kind of find himself again, like maybe get back in touch with a kind of an innocence, because he's lost everything, and maybe realised, okay, well, what does that leave me with?
Well, what's sort of left? Starting again means starting from the very beginning for him. Again.
Yeah, from childhood, you know.
Yeah,
and but it's a great performance as well. The way he plays it.
Maybe that's the last time he felt like he was actually. It's sort of innocent.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. Mm. And I love the way, there's just some great, the way that Richard Beamer can just chew the scenery as well. Like when he's talking to Hank and he's like, Jacques Renault is a psychopath. Psychopath, you know. Yeah. And Hank says that they're taking over, him and Renault are. We see Cooper receive a chess move in the mail, and it says that the king must die. We go over to Dougie's wedding, and it's so funny as well because I love the way that the priest who's sort of officiating, we haven't seen him since Laura's funeral. He was the joint at Laura's funeral, and it kicked off at that as well.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so he must just be like, what? Like, can I just officiate over some peaceful shit, please, you know? And I think it's fun. You do see a couple of characters as well, like the really large African American guy who is the coach. We haven't seen him, I don't think, since the pilot. I think he's the guy that picks up the phone when Laura's mum is phoning around everywhere in a frenzy, trying to figure out where Laura is. Like, is she with Bobby? Or you know, and again, it's a reminder that there are a whole load of characters. Again, I mean, Bobby's not in this episode. Shelley's not in it. Leo. Jacoby, you know, and a few of the characters like the Log Lady and Pete, we only get kind of very briefly.
Donna's only in one scene.
Yeah, yeah. So it is
only in one very small scene.
You know, it must be very difficult to be juggling it's not like a TV show like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. where you've got like six or seven characters, and when you have these storylines that change unexpectedly, or you've got to move the chess pieces around the board. This show has to juggle the needs of like 30 characters whilst doing that. And it's a little bit like trying to get an orchestra to improvise.
Yeah.
It's fine when you're a three-piece jazz band, but, you know, you can't get – the London Symphony Orchestra can't jam, you know. And it's – I think that's the situation.
Imagine what that would be like.
Well, yeah, I'd be curious to hear.
It'd be amazing.
But,
it'd be absolute dog's breakfast.
Yeah, well, yeah. One thing that I noticed, I didn't notice actually, it was pointed out to me, but I caught it in this episode, is Cooper's dressing gown is Leonard from The Big Bang Theory's dressing gown. It's the exact same dressing gown.
Yeah.
Not the same design.
Yeah, no, I know. We've already talked about
this. Oh, have we? Okay, yeah. That they found the prop in the studio, and they were like, we should use that for him.
Yeah.
And I've completely forgotten about that. And I was watching it, and I was like, oh, Cooper. But I thought, but now I was thinking of it the other way around. I was like, oh, Cooper's wearing Leonard's dressing gown, you know.
No.
I think you will find, sir. Good day. So
always be Cooper's.
We see Pete and the Log Lady at the wedding. Josie tells Catherine about Eckhard, and Catherine, in proper Joan Collins in Dynasty kind of, is like, right, okay, I own you now, because otherwise I can hand you over to Thomas Edgar.
And the breakfast order sounded awful, by the way. Dry toast and oatmeal.
Yeah, it's dry toast.
Oh.
And then it's so much like an episode of Dallas or Dynasty where the formerly dead person reveals themselves. And it's like, was he just standing in the doorway the whole? Yeah. It's one of those kind of like reveals that sort of can only happen on television.
Yeah. How has she not heard him breathing or seen him, like, seen his shadow?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, she was standing right there.
Well, it's like the moment in the the pilot episode of S.H.I.E.L.D. where Coulson reveals that he's still alive and he steps out and he's like, I didn't mean to be so dramatic. The lights are out back there. You know, it's one of those sort of like moments where you feel like they have to almost be self-referential. Okay, well, any final thoughts before I procrastinate so you can look at the next episode?
No final thoughts from me. I think I covered it all.
Alrighty then. Okay, well, we will be back very soon. Quick reminder that we appreciate feedback. And yeah, we've had a bit of a drought recently. So come on, Twin Peaks fans. Don't wait for season 3. We want to hear your thoughts on this controversial run of episodes in season 2. And you can do that at rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com or simply comment on the YouTube page. Check out our friend shows. Spotify and Apple Podcast reviews also appreciated. And I should mention that we are on social media, namely Instagram and Twitter, where in both cases, we are at Rewatch Proj. That's Rewatch P-R-O-J. What are we talking about next time, Hannah?
The next episode is number 12, The Black Widow. Synopsis says, Ben takes Bobby under his wing in a hope to destroy Hank and Jean. However, Ben's mental state is starting to crack. Cooper starts to look at buying real estate. Major Briggs' supervisor reveals that Briggs was studying the woods. It is directed by Caleb Deschanel and written by Harley Payton and Robert Ingalls.
Oh, that should be a good one there. They're a good writing team there.
Indeed.
All right. Okay. Well, looking forward to that. And we will be back very soon.
Take care, everybody.